What has changed in the last 5 days? What has changed? One thing, these murderers executed 6 of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head.
That is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who liberals are blaming for the murders committed by Hamas terrorists of Israeli civilians. Wrap your mind around that one for a moment. We've got, including the President of the United States, that reacts to the death of the hostages by saying Netanyahu isn't doing enough. What? Who killed the hostages? And who has been turning down ceasefire or hostage release negotiations?
Yeah, that's been part of the ceasefire.
By our own country.
Yeah, that's been part of the ceasefire plan is...
as part of a ceasefire.
Give back the hostages.
And anyway, we're going to get into that here in just a moment on the John Carlson Show. This is just outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. And it shows how completely divorced from simple, observable reality the White House has become and the chattering classes on the political left. But it's not just that. It just seems that reality has been suspended in all sorts of ways, including right here at home. When I read the Seattle Times editorial against the Climate Commitment Act, which actually left me feeling embarrassed for the Seattle Times. Because if you read the, or excuse me, if you read the editorial they wrote and then you juxtapose it with the editorial board meeting, which is on TVW, you just say, how could an editorial board made up of educated men and women who are supposedly, you know, open to discussion and persuasion, how could they land in the place they land and then write the editorial they wrote? Anyway, we've got a really stacked, busy show here, The Commute with Carlson. Here's what I'm talking about. At 6:35, we will have Todd Myers, who was one of the people who addressed the Seattle Times editorial board. Here's how it works. I've done these before. You appear at the newspaper either by yourself or with one other person. And next to you are the opponents, the people on the other side. Again, usually it's two people, one or two people. And the editorial board lines up on the other side of the table, and it could be anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 people, occasionally even more. And you make brief perfunctory remarks, and then they begin firing questions. And the Times has allowed TVW to broadcast, to tape and broadcast their editorial board meetings on, for instance, the gubernatorial endorsement and several other endorsements as well. And the editorial board presentation by both sides, Brian Haywood and Todd Myers, was just exemplary. It was just outstanding. And by the other side, it was a King County Councilman, Joe Fitzgibbon, and Rachel Smith. She is the current CEO of the Seattle Chamber, which almost always supports tax increases. It's just odd for a business group, but they've been doing that for a long, long time. They were, you know, okay, mostly boilerplate stuff. And it's just astounding to me that the Times came down where it did. But at this point, you look at where they landed on the governor's race, where they landed on the Seattle schools, or excuse me, the Washington State School Superintendent contest, David Olson versus the failed two-term incumbent Chris Rakedahl, and they come down for Rakedahl. And it's just, again, I'm embarrassed for the Seattle Times that they are so deep in the tank right now for one team. They've become a one-team player, it seems, on all the important, on the races that matter. They are all landing on the same spot. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. We not only have Todd Myers joining us on The Commute with Carlson today, we also will be talking to Brian Haywood about the state of the campaigns for the four initiatives. And also, there's going to be a hearing tonight at the Redmond City Council. Their city council is going to vote on whether or not to endorse 2117, which would cancel the Inslee invisible gas tax. The 30 to 52 cent increase, it ranges back and forth. It travels on that range. Again, all of it belying what Jay Inslee had promised, that it would be, oh, mere pennies and might even be less. But anyway, Brian will join us at 7:35. There is a absolute throwdown race for Pierce County executive. Who's going to run Pierce County? And basically, it's very simple. It's going to be an urbanist, liberal activist from Tacoma, named Ryan Mello, or it's going to be the moderately conservative state representative from Pierce County, Kelly Chambers. She will be joining me at 7:50. And that race, I mean, it's very simple. Does Pierce County want Tacoma city policies to also be the county's policies? And do you want to reverse 8 years of Bruce Dammeyer, who is the moderately conservative Republican Pierce County executive who formerly was a state senator? We have a couple of other guests that you're going to want to see. See if you could listen to all 3 hours of today's show. It's going to be that great. Cliff Mass from the University of Washington, the state's preeminent climate scientist, is actually, think about this. The state's preeminent climate scientist is coming out in favor of repealing the Climate Commitment Act. Cliff Mass will join us at 8:05 to tell us why and also what the reaction has been since he did this on his blog. It took a lot of guts for him to do that. And then finally, college football opens up its season. Both the Huskies and the Cougars won big time. The Seattle Mariners, they thought maybe they'd replace their manager and things would get better. Things not getting better. They lost two heartbreaking one-run games. They're running out of runway. Senior sports correspondent Matthew Carlson is going to join us to talk more about that. But let us begin with what happened after we got off the air on Friday over the weekend. Hamas slaughtered 6 hostages. Basically, they were worried that the hostages were going to be rescued. And they executed them, left their bodies in a tunnel. There has been outrage, but unbelievably, the outrage is being directed at Israel. At Israel. Let us start here with the mother of Hirsch Goldberg. Hirsch Goldberg, Poland, was just 23 years old. He's an American Israeli. He holds dual citizenship. And he held dual citizenship. He was 23 years old, and on October 7th, he was wounded and abducted, one of the hostages. They've had him for 10 months. And then, as you know, over the weekend, he was one of the six hostages killed. His mother, Rachel Goldberg, had actually spoke at the Democratic National Convention calling on Hamas to release the hostages, including her son. She spoke yesterday at her son's funeral. Here's part of what she said.
I send each of the families my deepest sympathies for what we are all going through and for the sickening feeling that we all could not save them. Okay, sweet boy, go now on your journey. I hope it's as good as the trips you dreamed about, because finally, my sweet boy, finally, 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 you're free. I will love you and I will miss you every single day for the rest of my life. But you're right here. I know you're right here. I just have to teach myself how to feel you in a different way. And Hirsch, there's one last thing I need you to do for us. Now I need you to help us stay strong. And I need you to help us survive.
Oh my God, that is just so heartbreaking. That is just wrenching to listen to. Talk about a mother's grief. Just awful. And so a reporter asked at a brief press scrum after Joe Biden gets off Marine One, asks him about the death of the hostages. Here is how he responded.
Mr. President, do you think it's time for Prime Minister Netanyahu to do more on this issue? Do you think he's doing enough?
No.
Do you think he's doing enough? No. So the hostages are dead because Benjamin Netanyahu didn't do enough. I think Benjamin Netanyahu has had enough of Joe Biden, who, again, is just beyond embarrassment. Trying to play both sides, trying to basically play the political calendar, the election calendar with this issue. Here's how Benjamin Netanyahu responded.
I was asked whether I'm not doing enough to the release of hostages. Well, I want to set the record straight. On April 27th, Secretary of State Blinken said that Israel made an extraordinarily generous offer for a hostage deal. On May 31st, Israel agreed to a U.S.-backed proposal. Hamas refused. On August 16th, Israel agreed to what the United States defined as a final bridging proposal. Hamas refused again. On August 19th, Secretary Blinken said, Israel accepted the U.S. proposal. Now Hamas must do the same. On August 28th, that's 5 days ago, Deputy CIA Director said that Israel shows seriousness in the negotiations. Now Hamas must show the same seriousness. I want to ask you something. What has changed in the last 5 days? What has changed? One thing. These murderers executed 6 of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head. That's what's changed. And now after this, we're asked to show seriousness? We're asked to make concessions? What message does this send Hamas? It says, kill more hostages, murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. The pressure internationally must be directed at these killers, at Hamas, not at Israel.
Exactly. Exactly. That's, again, Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, head of the Israeli government. I have told you since even well before last October 7th, I have been telling you, Hamas are barbarians. They're savages. They're vicious. They're barbarians. They want to exterminate the Israeli state and every Jew who tries to defend it, period. They want to exterminate the Israeli state and everyone who defends it, including, by the way, fellow Arab Muslims who believe in a two-state solution. If you want a two-state solution, Hamas, and you look like you're getting traction within the Arab Muslim world on that issue, that, you know, they're tired of all the killing, they're tired of all the misery, Hamas will kill you. They will mark you for death. Usually a gruesome death. That's what they are. So, again, I hope that Israel stands strong, stands firm. I hope they mark every leader of their ruling government, every leader who had a hand in this policy of October 7th, mark them for death. Take them out one at a time, but take them out and eliminate their military command as well. Eliminate. Be done with these people. Okay? Be done with Hamas. It is coming up here on 20 minutes, 21 minutes after 6 o'clock. Philip J. Vandervoort III back in the house along with the radio legend Mark Christopher. It's a great week ahead on The Commute with Carlson. September in full bloom on The Commute. Good morning. All right. Philip J. Vandervoort III, September, well underway. Third day of September. Hope you had a great Labor Day weekend.
Mine was great. Went to a cousin's wedding and saw a bunch of family and had a very sunny afternoon Saturday, just a little bit south of Bellingham near Lake Sammish.
Oh, that's a gorgeous place.
Worked out great.
Very nice.
Had a wonderful night.
So what's happening in the social media world?
I want to continue where you were talking about the Hamas-Israel situation, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, being criticized by... I guess, Western leaders, Joe Biden, amongst others. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. I was a little bit late to finding out about this news over the weekend because I was doing family stuff and things like that. When I started checking in on the news cycle yesterday, I came across a BBC article that I read through, and buried in the story, which was more about the protests in Israel and the people in Israel that are protesting in the streets that are upset with Benjamin Netanyahu, buried in this BBC story, I actually found some context, some useful information. It posted in the BBC story, it said local media reported that opposition leader Yair Lapid was present at these street protests in Israel. He's a former prime minister who leads the Yesh Atid party. Earlier, he had backed calls for a mass strike, a labor strike, to force Benjamin Netanyahu into a deal over the release of the hostages held by Hamas. And then a little bit later in the story, it says the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said he was committed to securing a deal that releases the remaining captives and protects the country's security. But he said, whoever murders hostages does not want a deal. That's kind of what you were getting at in the last segment. And then as it relates to the strikes, labor strikes in Israel as a form of protest. Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, was quick to condemn this general strike, claiming that it represented, quote, the interests of Hamas, end quote.
Well, yeah, I mean, to Netanyahu's...
But why does that get buried in the story? Shouldn't that be somewhere closer to the top?
To Netanyahu's point, if Hamas did want a deal,
yeah,
you know what they would... They wouldn't have shot six hostages. They would have let a couple of them go. They would have released a couple of hostages. Say, see, we are trying to get a ceasefire. We will allow these hostages to go. Yeah. So can we please now get serious about a ceasefire? That would have put immense pressure on Israel. But instead, being the barbarians they are, they shoot them. And Western governments, including Joe Biden, apparently ignoring his own Secretary of State and his own National Security Advisor and his own Deputy CIA Director, blames Netanyahu instead of Hamas.
And this brings me to a question for you, John. Here we are 60-something days away from the November 5th general election. Are any Democrats going to come out and say something to the effect publicly that, hey, Hamas, stop doing these things. You're helping Donald Trump win the election.
Oh, you have.
Because if this goes on and there's this stalemate and nothing gets accomplished, this is going to play into Donald Trump's campaign election momentum.
Well, you have.
And Democrats don't seem to acknowledge that.
Joe Biden said they will regret this. Oh, OK. Thanks, Joe. Hamas really you really got Hamas quaking in their boots. But again, they're only looking when they look at this issue, they aren't looking at the moral core of it. They're not looking at the foreign policy fallout. They're looking at the election calendar. That's all they're looking at. All right. When we come back, the Seattle Times heard from both sides on Initiative 2117, which would repeal the Climate Commitment Act's invisible tax on gasoline. And they come down in favor of higher prices for gasoline. They want a no vote. One of the people who spoke to the Times, Todd Myers, will be joining us to tell us what that was like. That's right around the corner on The Commute with Carl. Oh, boy, this is a real joyous pick-me-up song.
All these songs of September 3rd, early days of September, for some reason they were all in the slow tempo.
We're still going to have summer weather this week, okay?
Yeah, yeah. So, we're getting a gentle start to this short work week here.
So. We had fall weather yesterday, summer weather the rest of the week, I hope.
Yeah.
It is 23 minutes to 7 o'clock. The Seattle Times yesterday in their Sunday edition, Seattle Times on Sunday in their weekend editions, have decided to come down against Initiative 2117. They say, quote, climate change is already affecting Washington state in profound ways, including dangerous heat waves and uninvited smoke from burning forest fires, driving people inside during summer days. They say that the Climate Commitment Act is necessary if you want to get serious about those problems, and therefore they want a no vote on a piece of legislation that has raised gas prices between 30 and 52 cents a gallon. Todd Myers spoke to the Seattle Times. They had an editorial board meeting, and there were two people from each side, Joe Fitzgibbon, the King County councilman, and Rachel Smith from the Seattle Chamber on the no side, and Brian Haywood and Todd Myers on the yes side. Welcome, Todd. How are you?
I'm good this morning.
So tell me what you thought about the Seattle Times editorial.
Sadly predictable. I knew that going into that editorial board meeting that they were going to endorse keeping the CO2 tax because there's pressure on them, and it is a an environmental touchstone. It is, if you want to show how environmentally righteous you are, that's what you do. Is you you tax CO2 and fight climate change, and it's a good way to show how much you care. It's not a good way to reduce CO2 emissions. It does reduce CO2 emissions some, but it's extremely expensive. Like as we talked about before, it cost people in Washington twice as much as it did in California for the same amount of CO2 reduction. Anytime you're more expensive than California, that's something. And as they admitted in the editorial board meeting, the advocates of the CO2 tax, they don't even track the results of the expenditures. So it's a really bad way to fight climate change. But because it is symbolic of caring about climate change, I knew the Times would go along with it.
Well, not only that, they not only don't keep track of what they're buying, they kill the data on their existing performance. And for some reason, even though that played heavily in the editorial board meeting, I don't see it here in the editorial. Did I miss something?
Well, of course. I mean, you can't admit that we've had this very expensive thing that has raised, billions of dollars in taxes, and then say, well, we need to have it to fight climate change. There is an argument that says that we should tax, pollution. I know some people don't think CO2 is a pollution, but they do. And I think that there's some merit to that, right? We know CO2 has an impact. And so there's an argument that says, look, we should tax pollution, and that way we reduce the amount of pollution. But you can't make that argument if the money that you then spend doesn't actually reduce pollution. And that's what they admitted is that, no, we don't actually track to see whether this is the case. And how much we're reducing pollution, CO2 emissions. So that I think is the thing that they can't say, because if they say that, then people really go, well, what is the point here?
Well, let me give you an example of where I thought the Seattle Times was just showing bad faith in their editorial. They say Brian Haywood, the Redmond hedge fund manager who funded a raft of initiatives facing voters, says the Climate Commitment Act is, quote, so deeply flawed, close quote, there's no way to fix it. But in an interview, he offered no other solution in the face of a mounting problem. Well, my recollection watching the tape of the editorial board meeting is opinion columnist asked that question, but you answered it instead of Todd. So instead of giving the answer that you gave, because you gave the answer instead of Todd, they said, because you gave the answer instead of Brian, they said Brian Haywood had no answer.
Yes. Well, and I did, and I gave a variety of different answers, one of which is, look, if we're going to spend money to reduce CO2, we have to set metrics. We have to get the most bang for the buck. I told them, look, I wrote an entire book about this and encouraged them to get my book. I could use the sales. So, you're right. I did notice that they said Brian had no answer, which I did think is kind of cheap.
Again, you were taking turns answering questions. You answered that one, and so their response is Brian Haywood had no answer.
Well, but the other issue is that we each have our areas of expertise, and so I deferred to him on some areas, and he deferred to me on some areas. That's why you have two people. So yes, I thought that the way they wrote that, I don't know if they intended it that way, but it certainly comes off as disingenuous.
The Times editorial goes on to say, that actually if voters repeal the Climate Commitment Act, it will mean more onerous regulation on business.
Well, and that I think is very funny, because what they said is, if we get rid of this, then the Department of Ecology is going to react by doing even more dumb things. And I think that's a very strange argument to make. It's, here's an idea. Don't do dumb things. Do things that are effective. And there's lots of things and we have advocated for things that are effective that you can do within the current framework of the law. You can expend money that reduces CO2 emissions very effectively and very cost effectively. But they won't do those things. The reason they won't do those things is that it doesn't expand government, is that it doesn't give them more power, and it doesn't benefit special interests, because what we're asking for is to focus on things that are very effective, but often not very sexy. And that's the other thing is that the things that they want to do are very high profile. So I thought, it was a really poor argument to say, well, we'll punish you. If you don't do what we want, we're going to have to punish you by making it even worse. And that wasn't the only place. There's this claim that if we repeal the CO2 tax, that it will harm roads and bridges. This is one of their main arguments.
Right.
And I went in there with this express purpose of showing that that was false. And they finally admitted, Joe Fitzgibbon, who's the state legislator who helped write the law, admitted that that wasn't the case. But he said, but if you take this money away, then we will have to steal money from roads and bridges to do the things we want to do. So again, it's about punishing the voters for doing the wrong thing. And I thought that the Seattle Times made that explicit by saying, well, the Department of Ecology will have to punish the voters. Sure. And Joe Fitzgibbon said, well, we will have to punish the voters by taking money away from roads and bridges because they didn't do what we wanted.
Right. Again, they get the votes from the Greens by saying the Climate Commitment Act does not allow a penny. Not a penny is allowed to be spent on roads and bridges, i.e. 18th Amendment appropriation or expenditures. And yeah. Then they try and get people who like roads and bridges on board by saying, you understand, we'll have to take money from roads and bridges to pay for these things that are otherwise subsidized by the Climate Commitment Act. They're trying to play both sides.
Yeah, they speak out of both sides of their mouth. And I mean, there's another part of it, and this is in the interview that people can watch the interview. Rachel Smith, who's the head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, really made some bizarre and ridiculous arguments. Her main argument was that if voters repeal the CO2 tax, there's no guarantee that prices will go down. This is ridiculous, right? This is saying, well, okay, just because we cut taxes doesn't mean prices will go down. And what's interesting is they kept commenting that BP, British Petroleum, BP, one of the world's largest oil companies, is supporting them. Well, in fact, when the prices of the CO2 tax went down, because it's based on an auction over the last year, guess what? Guess the tax went down. And BP, I have the invoices that show BP cut their costs. And so you have this, the head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce saying that cutting taxes doesn't cut prices.
Yeah.
I don't know this is the Seattle, this is a Chamber of Commerce making these arguments. It's no, ridiculous.
Rachel does not have a business background. And this is one of the problems of the Seattle Chamber is they often are a voice for interest groups, nonprofits, government agencies, and very big behemoth businesses like Microsoft. Yeah. Great. I thought your performance at the Ed Board was exemplary. I want to encourage our listeners, go to TVW and just Seattle Times Editorial Board Initiative 2117 and watch it yourself. It is, again, just an instruction on the gap between not just the gap in opinion, but the gap in content and substance between the two sides. Todd Myers, they can find that at WashingtonPolicy.org.
Yep, and we will be releasing some more information about some of the other things that the other side admitted during that about the costs and about the ineffectiveness at WashingtonPolicy.org over the next couple months.
We'll be directing people to that website, of course, WashingtonPolicy.org. Todd Myers, thank you this morning. Great hearing from you. Appreciate you making the time.
Good to talk with you.
Lars Larson, right around the corner. It's 11 minutes to 7 o'clock. All right, back we are with the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, Tuesday edition of the radio program record, this third day of September. And my buddy Lars Larson, our noon to 3 host, checking in. Good morning, Lars.
Good morning, John. It's a target-rich environment out there, and we've got, what, less than 90 days before the election. But there are a lot of things going on in the Northwest that I think are fascinating.
I think we're getting close to 60 days.
Yeah, we're getting close to it. But
and you heard
and
about
of course, since the ballots go out in a month, I guess we're really, 5 weeks away from people beginning to vote.
That is true. We're about 5 weeks out from people voting for president. Unbelievable that it's gotten that close already. But, you know, Labor Day is supposedly the starting mark for, the fall election season.
Always used to be, yeah.
So the Linwood Light Rail Station.
This bugs me. And I'll tell you what, I want to zap Como. I saw the story that they did. Oh, isn't this train great? Isn't it wonderful? Oh, everybody rides it all the time. The thing is, transit has declining ridership per capita in the Northwest, not just Seattle, but Portland, too. So you're pumping billions, literally billions, into a system where fewer and fewer people are using it per capita, which makes no sense. This latest extension, which I noticed reporters didn't plug in the numbers, $3 billion for 8.5 miles. I'll do the math. That's $352 million a mile. And if you compare it to conventional transit, you could buy 700 modern buses for what 1 mile of that extension cost.
Also,
and it's flexible.
Yes. Also, quote, the four new stations where train service begins began last weekend, quote, will make life easier for people nearby who already use public transportation.
Yep. All it means is existing bus riders have switched over to the multi-billion dollar rail.
Again, Sound Transit, the most expensive way ever devised to move as few people for as much money as possible. Hour number two of the commute right around the corner. Back we are, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hope you all had a great Labor Day weekend. I got a bunch of stuff. I actually stayed home and did a bunch of stuff in the yard.
I'm looking at all the sunburns here. When's the last time we had sunburns following Labor Day weekend?
Wow. And, you know, a couple of nice long motorcycle rides, one of them east past Snoqualmie. And the other yesterday, Whidbey Island. The weather could have been a little drier and a little warmer, but still it was just a lot of fun. Whidbey Island is just gorgeous. So much.
Yeah, they had quite a music festival in Oak Harbor, I heard.
They had a great music festival.
Yeah.
And I talked to a couple of friends who were at it. It was a free 2-day music festival. And I said, what kind of music? You know, jazz, blues, country music? I said, it was everything. They played rock. They played jazz. They played gospel. And the acts were really good. And people just went there and sat back and enjoyed music, live music. So what a great weekend up at Whidbey Island. And also, here's something interesting. I didn't get a chance to see. I'm going to see it this week. That new movie about President Reagan, simply called Reagan.
Yeah, I saw some previews for that. And Dennis Quaid.
Dennis Quaid, who I've been watching since the movie Breaking Away.
Good reminder.
One of the kids from
Bicycle Riders.
In this Indiana small town, happens to be a university town. Anyway, he plays President Reagan, does, I am told, a really good job. Now, here's what's interesting. The critics, as you can guess, hate this movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Because Reagan is a Republican, and the Republicans are the good guys.
Portrayed positively, right?
Now, it's not... It's not they're the good guys, the Democrats are the bad guys. They're the good guys, and the Soviets are the adversary, okay? It's a biopic, so it starts with Ronald Reagan as a little boy growing up, his Hollywood years, including when he started to get into politics, which was ironically when communists tried to take over the Screen Actors Guild. And he went, got from there and further into politics and then elected governor in California way back in 1966. And then his years as president. The audiences love this movie.
Yeah.
The audience approval rate was 98%.
That's very high.
Virtually unheard of.
And this is not a Marvel hero.
Right. Deadpool, that's still doing really well.
It's, yes.
It's become one of the biggest, it is the most successful R-rated movie of all time. The other thing is that they were predicting that Reagan would not do well at the box office. Well, it did. It exceeded expectations. It's currently the fourth biggest movie in the country.
Yeah. I didn't see a lot of interview of Dennis Quaid. I caught one clip, though, and this was after he completed the movie and went through the preview of it and then watched some people, maybe younger, watching it for the first time and said, boy, can you relate to what happened then with all that's going on now? Yeah, because you'll see what we had inflation at that time, oil supply issues, interest rates back in the days of Reagan.
Yes,
so
yes.
Kind of a learning movie if you want to go see this to understand all that's going on now. It's not the first time.
No, the inflation under Biden-Harris, the Biden-Kamala Harris administration, was higher than any time since Jimmy Carter. And, of course, when Jimmy Carter left, he left Ronald Reagan with very high interest rates, very high inflation, and rising unemployment. They had to invent a new term for it. They called it stagflation, when both inflation and unemployment rise at the same time, because usually it's, it doesn't work that way, economists tell us, but that's what was happening. And so the 1980s were also similar in some ways to many, many Americans began to think in the late 70s that, you know, this America may have hit its peak. Our best days may be behind us. That's what a lot of serious people were thinking, because not only that, the price of gas was going through the roof because as the political class assured us, we were running out of oil. And anyone who tells you different, anyone who says we're not running out of oil, is either in the pocket of the oil industry or they're just extreme. They're out there way out on the fringes.
They're a denier.
Does that sound familiar, ladies and gentlemen? Here we were told that because energy shortages were a fact of life for the rest of our lives, we needed to lower the speed limit to 55. We need a federal Department of Energy. We need, at one point, they were telling people not to hang Christmas lights. I was there. I saw it. I remember it. And it was, again, because the experts were assuring us, world leaders, the United Nations, everybody knew, close quotes.
Academia.
That was the direction that we were going in, that, as Jimmy Carter put it, we would not be able to import a barrel of oil by 1987 for any acceptable price whatsoever. So that's when in 1978-79, Jimmy Carter was telling us by the late 80s, we're done. Look how preposterously wrong they were. Look how preposterously wrong the New York Times was, the Washington Post. The media were echoing this. And again, anyone who said different was, well, they're just a lackey of the oil industry. or they're just extreme. They're out there on the fringes. That is precisely what we hear now about climate change. And it's the same type of people. In the case of people like John Kerry, it's the same people who were clueless back then. Anyway, welcome to the John Carlson Show. Thought you would want to know that there is a lawmaker in Olympia, and I know him well, Andrew Barkus. He is from Yelm. And he is renewing his call for tougher penalties when protesters block freeways, you know, like I-5 or airports, you know, like SeaTac. Jeremy Harris tracks the story from Como 4.
Freeway protests and roadblocks hoping to get a message out. They are meant to be disruptive.
Do protesters have any right to use interstate freeways for free speech in Washington?
No. No, it's against the law.
But Representative Andrew Barkus says the state of Washington needs to send a message to protesters.
It's frustrating because it's being allowed. And because we're not doing anything to put consequences or accountability to those that are doing this, it continues.
Barkus plans to bring back his bill to charge protest organizers with felonies if they block highways or airports.
The protesters, their attorneys may say, listen, we have a First Amendment right, and protesting on the freeway being disruptive is part of that right. As a state lawmaker, what do you say about that?
It never has been intended for pedestrians to be on the freeway. It is illegal. It is in statute against the law.
Right now, the Washington Attorney General's office is defending the state patrol from a lawsuit claiming troopers didn't do enough to block off I-5 during a freeway protest in 2020. That's when protester Summer Taylor was killed.
For the love of Pete, pedestrians are prohibited from going on the freeway.
Barkus says the state has given too much leeway to protesters, and he thinks lawmakers need to correct that.
I hope my colleagues can see that there is a sentiment in Washington state surrounding all of public safety. I think that people are really demanding, the constituents and citizens are demanding more accountability.
Barkus says we likely will have a better idea towards the end of the year exactly what his proposal to lawmakers will be, and he'll have a challenge in getting them to pass that because he tried to pass a similar bill earlier this year, but it didn't make it through the House. Reporting live in Seattle, Jeremy Harris, Como News.
No, it didn't make it because this legislature approves of the causes or of the political causes that are being promoted by these demonstrations. If this had been a tactic of the, let's say, right to life movement or the anti-trans movement, that they were blocking freeways and blocking airports on behalf of the right to life cause or in opposition to transgender ideology, oh, for heaven's sakes, that bill would have gone through the legislature like crap through a goose. I mean, that would have been the easiest pass in the legislature. But because these venues, these roads, these bridges, these airport access roads are being blocked to promote the cause of Hamas, and more importantly for the left, to denigrate Israel, then of course that bill doesn't pass. This is one more reason why we need better people in Olympia, more balance in the legislature. It's also why we need Dave Reichert as governor. There's someone who understands that when you break the law, there should be consequences. Not so much Bob Ferguson. You don't hear him calling for such a bill. So one more reason why, hey, elections really do have consequences. And let's hope we get the right people in there. You're listening to the radio program of record, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Still to come on The Commute with Carlson, Brian Haywood going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour, the most consequential man in Washington state politics. A quick review, quick update, on how the initiatives are going, and the Seattle Times just, again, embarrassing, meaning they embarrass themselves, editorial urging a no vote on 2117. And then a throwdown. I just love this. Every once in a while, you get an absolute, you know, distinctive choice. There's no middle. The middle is exploded. Choose one side or the other. In Pierce County, they will have a choice between an ardently liberal urbanist Tacoma, former councilman, or I think Ryan Mello is still on the city council. Ryan Mello is his name, versus State Representative Kelly Chambers, who I think is from the Puyallup area in Pierce County. It doesn't get the choices more stark than that. She will be joining us at 7:50. And, of course, with the college football season now underway, we have to have a little sports rundown, 8:35, with our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson. It's all in front of us here on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 18 minutes after 7. Ah, here we go. Earth, Wind, and Fire, who are coming to Seattle this week, I believe. September, one of their biggest hits. Philip J. right around the corner with the social media sweep. 18 and a half minutes after 7.
To that. Tonight, Climate Pledge Arena. Earth, Wind, and Fire with their good friends, Chicago.
What a double bill.
Yeah. It looks like some VIP seats are available, but get on it like now. These two jammed together when they were younger. They collaborated. Nobody ever knew. They shared ideas here with the horn sections and lyrics and good friends together tonight in Seattle. Climate Pledge.
Climate Panic Arena, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Chicago. Double bill. And how many more times are you going to have that opportunity to see these bands, huh?
Might be a one and done.
All right.
Given those circumstances.
Philip J. Vandervoort III, it is 24 minutes after 7 o'clock. What does the social media world look like at this very moment in time?
The sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Let's check in on the state of Oregon, Portland specifically, because they just had a new law go into effect that says you can be arrested for illegal drug possession. And KPIX is the Fox affiliate down there. KPTV is the are the call letters for the Fox affiliate in Portland. Headline says, four arrests in downtown Portland on the first day that drugs become illegal again. Two of those arrested were sent to what they're calling in Portland deflection services. Otherwise, this would be known as diversion, where you get the option if you get arrested illegally possessing drugs to go into rehab. So the story says that two of the four applied to or submitted for the diversion thing. But Portland now has a new law in effect as of last, I guess it would have been Sunday for the first day of the month, that possession of small amounts of drugs now illegal in Oregon again. And that law applies to drugs like fentanyl, heroin, and meth. And it was voters who basically voted to throw those drug possession laws out. And now they have come back into effect in Portland.
Well, you know, if they're going to make drugs illegal again because of the disaster with their experiment mm-hmm. of removing criminal penalties from personal drug use...
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, Washington State watched this disaster unfolding and said, why don't we try that?
Yeah.
And, of course,
they did for a while.
We've hastily changed, though, frankly, the legislature was dragged kicking and screaming, didn't want to do it. But they had to do it. Yeah. But they didn't go far enough. Neither has Oregon, by the way. There need to be real consequences.
Well, and again,
not diversion.
Yeah,
real consequences.
It's one thing, I think, if you are going to be a drug user and you can consume drugs and do it within the confines of your own home. But when you make your drug consumption out in public on the street, and then you are intoxicated and out on the street and out of control, and heaven forbid if you end up having to go commit crimes to support your drug habit because you're out on the street and you can't work and you can't provide for yourself and you can't sustain yourself, then yes, that's where you have to have the checks and balances. But that's what was completely overlooked in so much of this drug decriminalization hullabaloo. Reason website, reason.com, has a story that kind of goes to what you've been talking about a little bit this morning regarding Initiative 2117 that's up for vote in this state, and that would repeal this scheme Governor Inslee and the Washington Democrats and legislature passed for their carbon pricing scheme.
It
raises the price of gasoline and other fossil fuels.
It's a backdoor tax on people who drive, period.
Reason.com posted their story. Gas prices in California are exceptionally high because of the state's high taxes and anti-oil regulations, not because gas station owners there are greedier. You go into the story, it says, so why is there so little competition among oil refineries in California? First, California mandates an environmental-friendly formulation of gasoline, which means they cannot bring in gasoline that's sold in Nevada or Oregon or formulated for those states. It says California's more restrictive gasoline specs can limit the availability of supply from other markets. And that's according to the U.S. Energy Information Agency. Second, California pumps out the highest state gas tax in the nation, 77.9 cents per gallon. So if you think gas companies, oil companies are greedy for how much they make per gallon, remember, the state of California makes 77.9 cents per gallon of gas sold. And
certainly more than the energy industry makes
reason,
off a gallon of gas.
The Reason.com story points out, although it's not a tax per se, California has a new low-carbon fuel standard issued by the California Air Resources Board, which essentially acts as a 52-cents-a-gallon tax. Then you have state gas prices currently in California, $1.30 higher than the national average, but the differential will increase thanks to Gavin Newsom's supported state policy. Apparently, the governor doesn't want gasoline prices to fall, or at least low prices aren't much of a priority in California. And then it points back to, the only way to bring down gas prices in California would be to have more refinery capacity. And with all these anti-fossil fuel laws, what fossil fuel company is going to decide to expand their oil refinery side of the business?
Mm-hmm.
They're not.
Well,
you're stuck.
If I'm not mistaken, Chevron,
formerly
once known as Standard Oil of California, has just announced they're moving their corporate headquarters out of California. I think that's a hint. I think that's a hint about California and gas prices and how they treat the energy industry. By the way, Washington and California have the highest gas taxes in the country. They are the only taxes with this Climate Commitment Act scheme, as you so aptly put it, Philip J., in place. All right, Brian Haywood, the most consequential man in Washington state politics, right around the corner here. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Here's how much America has changed over time. This is a song from over 40 years ago, where someone gets busted for smoking in the boys' room. We went from that to the enlightened policy of actually having smoking areas in school for kids, students.
Yeah.
Smoking rooms for students.
Courtyards, too. Yeah.
And then they realized, hey, maybe we shouldn't be telling people that you kill yourself smoking and then give you a place to smoke. So now smoking rooms are not only gone for students, they're gone for faculty. They're gone for janitors in the furnace room. No, anyway, that's how much the country has changed. All right. Brian Haywood is trying to change Washington State for the better. He is the man, and along with Let's Go Washington, the organization he has created, that I think is the most seminal, the most consequential organization in the state of Washington, if you're talking about changing how Washington is governed, giving the people the final word on the major issues. Good morning, Brian Haywood. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. And I was going to add to your intro, you can, it's changed so much that now you can smoke pot, but if you smoke a cigarette, they'll arrest you.
That's right. What are you smoking there? A Marlboro? Oh, it's a doobie. Well, no problem. For a moment there, I thought you were smoking a cigarette. Very good. Good social commentary there, Brian. Okay. The Seattle Times editorial coming out against your initiative 2117. We talked to Todd Myers last hour about it. I thought it was an amazingly embarrassing piece that the Times wrote here.
And completely shocking, unexpected. Who would have guessed? Who would have guessed that the Seattle Times, who makes their living off of paid propaganda called the Climate Laboratory, would go against this bill?
Good point. Their climate lab is subsidized by the green lobby, by green activists and foundations and individuals who are, how do we call it, urbanist, and basically reflect the Jay Inslee view of climate. That's a great point. One of the things that caught my attention that I thought was such a cheap shot and just so beneath the Seattle Times, because I know several of the people on the editorial board, and, you know, bottom line, they know better than this. It says, Brian Haywood, the Redmond hedge fund manager who funded a raft of initiatives facing voters, says the Climate Commitment Act of 2021 is so deeply flawed, there's no way to fix it. But in an interview, he offered no other solution in the face of a mounting problem. Well, I watched that editorial board meeting on 2117 between you and Todd Myers, who are for it, and Rachel Smith from the Seattle Chamber, and state legislator Joe Fitzgibbons. And when the question was asked, well, what are your solutions if you don't like the Climate Commitment Act? Todd answered the question. And he gave a very good answer, very comprehensive and copious answer about what he would do in place of the Climate Commitment Act. And then the interview goes on. But instead, in an interview, Haywood offered no other solution. Well, you weren't the one who answered the question. Todd was. You guys were going back and forth. So
I think what they were doing is they were sort of embarrassed by the poor performance of the no on 2117, and they were trying to make up for it. One of the questions they asked, we put it forward that, hey, the biggest problem with this, if you really believe that this is existential, that we have to do something on the environment now, then it's paramount that you measure how much impact we're having. I mean, that should be top priority. And Joe Fitzgibbons basically said, not only were they not measuring it, but they had not contemplated any sort of measurement system when they designed the law. And that was bad enough. But then what was interesting is just when the Seattle Times jumped at one of the board members jumped at me and said, well, why didn't you make a initiative to force them to measure things? And like that, like it was my problem that they had designed this really poorly.
Right.
Thing.
I saw that.
It took me aback that he was yelling at me for something that they had said, no, we don't have any measurement program. Brian Haywood, why didn't you fix it? And maybe I should take that as a compliment. The Seattle Times knows that the legislature can't get it done, so they need me to fix it.
Well, yes. Once you've solved other people's problems, can you please solve ours as well? I mean, so anyway, I wanted to bring you on because you are from Redmond and you follow local politics in Redmond, and something is happening tonight.
That's right. There's a board meeting, a city council meeting tonight that's open to the public. It starts at 7, but really people need to get there by 6:30, and we'd recommend people go there. They have a motion to reject, to unendorse, if you will, or to not endorse or to recommend against I-2117. And if you look into the details of why they're doing it, Redmond, and this is really, it's the whole picture in miniature here. Mm-hmm. Redmond's getting about $1 million this year. They got $2 million grant from the CCA. So this is the Jay Inslee. We're going to get everybody to support it by giving $1 million here, $1 million there. I'm taking your money, dear commuter. Every day I'm taking your money when you commute, and I'm going to give it to cities like Redmond so they can do bike lanes, which Redmond's been doing anyway without the state's help. So they've got $1 million that they get. And then this is the dirty part. They're told another $1 million is online, but if 2117 passes, they don't get that second $1 million. And you know, that's sort of a, let's call it government extortion, right?
Well, yes, so, it's in your interest to actively politic for this tax increase, for this initiative, which, again, I found amazing. Rachel Smith said there is no guarantee. If I'm not mistaken, she said there's no guarantee prices will come down. What?
Well, and especially when they denied they're not going to go up, they're not going to go up. Oh, they went up? Well, there's no guarantee they'll go down. Okay, who are you going to believe?
Well, I Todd Myers put it so well. He said, let me get this straight. You're saying that when you cut taxes, prices don't go down? This is interesting for the head of a business organization, which the Seattle Chamber officially is known as, but has, for heaven's sakes, a 30-year record of supporting higher taxes. Of course, being there and not offering much in the way of pushback while Seattle's decline vastly accelerated over the last dozen years. Anyway, Brian Haywood, real quickly, can you give us an update on the initiative campaigns so far here? We're almost, 64 days out? 62
yes.
days out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We've got the big piece right now. There's a couple of things. In fact, I'm going up to Marysville today. We're doing gasoline events all over the state. So we're going to a gasoline station in Marysville this afternoon from 2 to 4. If anyone happens to be up there, they can get their gas, buy gas at a reduced the national average. we'll be doing a series of those. We also have begun a very targeted canvassing. So we went out and we made a model to find voters who might not be aware of the initiatives, but would be likely to vote for them. And so we're going out and knocking on their doors and letting them know about them and getting commitments to vote in October. And that's been going very, very well. If people are interested in doing that and in a paid way, we'll hire them. So come to letsgowa.com. And then we've got, if you go to also to our website, the first of four of our videos, they're long, they're about 8 minutes, but the first of four of our videos to sort of educate people on them is out. And then we've got another campaign that we'll reveal at some point, a sort of an interesting, we'll hit the digital and the okay. airwaves a little bit with a campaign
right.
that way.
That gas price rollback is happening at the Union 76 station on 172nd Street Northeast in Marysville. Brian Haywood, always great getting an update from you. Thanks very much for joining me. We'll talk later this week.
If we can get everybody out tonight to Redmond, we would really love to have the support. So thank you, John, always, and we'll talk to you later.
Redmond City Hall, 6:30 this evening. Redmond City Hall, 6:30 this evening. Be heard at Redmond City Hall. Thank you, Brian Haywood. It's Boeing time on the commute, 7:47. When we come back, an absolutely epic battle going on in Pierce County. You're going to want to hear this right around the corner. What a throwdown we have for the role of Pierce County Executive. Bruce Dammeyer, term limited, not running. He's been there at the helm for 8 years, and moderate Republican who has been very popular. But Pierce County is going to choose a direction. It's either going to go left or it's going to stay where it is and maybe, you know, head further towards the right. State Representative Kelly Chambers, Republican from the Puyallup South Hill area, is running. Her opponent is ardently liberal Ryan Mello from the Tacoma City Council. Kelly Chambers joins us here on the morning commute. How are you, Kelly?
Well, I'm recovering from last night at the fair, John.
Oh, do tell. Do tell, yes.
Yes, last night was the Turtles and the Association playing at the fair in the grandstand, their concert series. So
we gave out tickets to that concert.
Happy Together.
Yes, the Happy Together tour. Absolutely. Well, good. I'm glad you had a great time. Every once in a while, you get a race where it's not, you know, two quasi-similar candidates. It's a very stark difference between the opponents, and that's what we have here in Pierce County.
Right.
What are the stakes?
We're really at a fork in the road with what the future of Pierce County looks like in this race. And I think, you know, most people, you know, going about their daily lives and maybe haven't been looking at county government and how it's been run. But we've had great leadership with Bruce Dammeyer in the last 8 years and a sustainable budget, which is, you know, really reflective of life here.
What's at stake? What happens if he wins instead of you win?
If he wins, Pierce County becomes a lot less affordable to live in, and you can guarantee that you will have homeless tent encampments spread throughout the county.
Because?
My opponent has, he's currently on Pierce County Council and has proposed changing the ordinance and permitting so that you can site homeless tent encampments anywhere outside of the city of Tacoma. So that means everywhere else in Pierce County.
Yeah, that alone should be the issue that defines this race. I misspoke when I said Tacoma City Council. I think he was on the Tacoma City Council and ran for Pierce County Council.
Right.
And so what will be different if Kelly Chambers is there? We got about a minute.
Well, it'll be different that we will continue to maintain a sustainable budget and be thoughtful about our approach to homelessness. It's a complex situation with, you know, people that are in the throes of addiction. There are no easy answers to homelessness, and I think everybody probably understands that at this point. But we want to have a thoughtful approach that helps bring people out of addiction.
Didn't Ryan Mello support decriminalization?
Right.
Back when, during the Blake decision, wasn't he a voice for that? Well, that's another stark difference between the two of you.
And I don't think it's, not just Pierce County, but really every city and county is kind of in this situation right now where they have gotten lots of federal funds, ARPA dollars from the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And based on how your local jurisdiction chose to spend that money is really going to impact the financial future of the county or city budget.
Kelly, what's your website?
It's kellychambers.org.
kellychambers.org. kellychambers.org. Go to her website. Learn more about this. It's a fascinating race. We're not done with Pierce County. We're going to be paying more attention to this race. It's that important. Thanks for joining us this morning, Kelly. I have 70 KVI. We are between now and the election going deep on several key vital contests, whether they involve initiatives, whether they involve candidates, whether they are running for federal office, whether they are running for statewide or even some local offices. One such example, an absolutely up or down vote on our future, is the Climate Commitment Act. And whether we are going to embrace among the largest gas tax increases, gasoline price increases in the country, or whether we are going to say no, it, the There's no call for that. There's no justification for that. We've been talking about the Seattle Times editorial saying that you should vote no. And interestingly, someone who says you should vote yes happens to be the most esteemed and influential climate scientist in the state of Washington. It's Cliff Mass, who's no stranger to KVI listeners, someone who sticks rigorously to the science and therefore is not a fan of alarmists of either the left or the right. Cliff Mass joins me this morning on the John Carlson Show. How are you, Cliff?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
And thank you again for joining me. I want to read, here's the two opening paragraphs of the Seattle Times editorial asking people to vote no on Initiative 2117 that would repeal the Climate Commitment Act and what is called the invisible tax, the carbon tax on gasoline. Here's the first paragraph. Climate change already is affecting Washington state in profound ways, including dangerous heat waves and the too frequent uninvited smoke from burning forest fires that drives people inside during summer days. Is that a true statement?
No. And, you know, that's one problem with the Seattle Times article is that, or whatever you want to call it, the editorial. You know, they're making claims that climate change is causing all kinds of stuff, like the wildfires. Climate change is really a very small contributor to it. In fact, you know, I'm doing research on exactly that topic. So that's a problem just to start off with, you know, in that editorial.
Let me go to the second paragraph. Waterways are warming. A statewide drought and lackluster snowpack have wreaked havoc on the state's farmers, fish populations, and even hydroelectric power generation. Ever drier forests are increasingly at risk of more frequent and intense fires. July marks the 14th consecutive month of global record high temperatures, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Is that an accurate paragraph?
It isn't, and I'll tell you why. First, the question of drought. Is drought becoming more frequent here? It turns out that the amount of precipitation is unchanging. If we look at the records, the rainfall here is not declining, and in fact, climate models don't suggest it will. And then the snowpack, which eventually will decrease as we warm, it hasn't shown much sign of it. If you look at the snowpack in the Cascades, over the last, let's say, 30, 40 years, there's hardly been any decline, just a slight decline. So, I mean, these claims of terrible things happening with water are simply untrue.
Why is Cliff Mass, instead of just staying quiet, because I'm assuming, and we'll talk about this in a moment, I assume you're taking some grief for coming out in favor of Brian Haywood's Initiative 2117 to repeal the Climate Commitment Act, why are you urging people to vote yes?
Well, I think there's some terribly things wrong with this Climate Commitment Act. And I can just go through the list of it. Number one, it is terribly regressive. So the way it works is that, you know, poor people are hit much harder than richer people. The gas prices went up initially about 50 cents per gallon, and that's just the gas at the pump. And the natural gas for heating your homes, that went up. Everything else goes up as well because you have to transport things around. And the people that are hurt the most are people that are lower income. Now, it didn't have to be designed that way. I was supportive of another carbon initiative, mm-hmm. 1631, back several years ago, and that taxed carbon but gave the money back to low-income people. This does not do that. So the fact it's highly regressive, that's one problem. Another problem is how deceptive its advocates have been, including the governor. I mean, the governor stated explicitly that, it'll have hardly any effect on gas prices, pennies, Well, it was more like 50 cents, and we ended up with close to the most expensive gas in the country. In fact, we did have the most expensive gas in the country for a while. So lying to the public is really bad. Another problem is there's no measures of success. They're given, so far, in the first year, they brought in $1.5 billion. That's a lot of money. And to all kinds of projects. And there's no measure of success. Are these projects actually reducing emissions, reducing carbon in the atmosphere? There's nothing there. And finally, if you look at the list of projects, I mean, half the projects have very little to do with climate change and emissions. I mean, you can get to the list online, but some of them are just very silly and, you know, politically oriented and have very little to do with climate change. So it's been basically creating a huge slush fund for the legislature. So, you know, if you care about climate change, I care about climate change, this is not the way to do it. Very ineffective, very wasteful, and very deceptive.
Let me run for our listeners what the governor said in July of 2022. After the Climate Commitment Act passed and shortly before it went into effect, he was being interviewed by reporter Matt Markovich. Mark Christopher, could we please go back and get audio here? Here we go.
At what point are you going to tell the people of Washington State that they're going to possibly see much higher gas prices next year because of the CO2 emissions tax?
Which... Well, that's not true. They are not going to see much higher gas prices, maybe even lower than they are today.
Maybe even lower than they are today, said the governor in 2022, Cliff Mass.
Well, that's not telling the truth. And that's a problem.
Strikes me as overwhelming is how the elites in Washington State are putting vast amounts of money into the 2117 campaign. You have Bill Gates has donated $1 million at least so far. You have Steve and Connie Ballmer. I think they're in for $2.5 million on this. So they clearly are going to have more money when it comes to advertising. They have a very obscure ballot title, but they've attached to it a message that on the ballot itself, it says this will take money away from transportation and other investments. And they also, of course, are trying to get government agencies that are getting money from this. Governments like Redmond City Council is going to be voting on this tonight to come out against it. So, if you will, the forces of political clout are all marshaled in support of a no vote here.
Well, that's true, but I think they're going to lose. I mean, the initial polling suggests overwhelming support for this vote. And, you know, we've seen some other initiatives about carbon. And people do not like to be taxed at the pump like this. And they certainly don't like being deceived. So I have a feeling this is going to win.
The people will see through it?
I think people will see through it. And I think people are sensitive to having these gas prices that are wild, right? And the fact they were lied to, I mean, you play the tape, it's so obvious that they've been deceived. And I don't think people like it. So I'm very optimistic that this will pass.
You know, I share your optimism because all you have to do is remind people that this was a 43 cent plus gallon backdoor gas tax. So if you want to pay less, vote yes.
That's right. That's a very simple message, and I think people can understand that.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's beyond that. People don't like being deceived, and now it's very clear they were, and I think that's also very powerful.
So, when you're looking at the overall issue of climate change politics in the United States today, Cliff Mass, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
The politics,
yes.
Or about dealing with climate change?
Well, I know you've made it clear that with technology and the fact that this is a slow-moving challenge, you feel quite optimistic that...
Right. I'm extremely optimistic. I mean, the effects of climate change, you know, they're there, but they're far less draconian and serious than some people are suggesting. They're using it as a tool. So climate change is less of a problem. And the big thing is technology can get us out of this. I mean, it's really pretty simple. We're putting too much of a certain gas up there. We need alternative energy supplies. And clearly, in the long term, you know, we can use nuclear power and particularly fusion power, which will eventually be available, to replace a lot of the use of fossil fuels. That is only a matter of time. So we do have options. So I'm very optimistic in the long period. But we got to be very clear. The impacts of the warming are really quite modest. And more important than that, technology like air conditioning has really reduced the effects of heat events. So there's no end of the world problem, and it's one that we can solve.
Oh, the other thing is that we keep hearing, for instance, about deaths caused by excessive heat. But deaths caused by excessive cold weather are far more numerous.
That's correct. Way, way more people die of cold than heat. And obviously, when you warm up, you have less cold deaths. Okay, so that's going on. But there's something else going on. The percentage of people that are dying from heat has been going down. And that's because there's more air conditioning available. Mm. There's more cooling available. And it's not only true here, but in other countries as well. People can live in Phoenix, Arizona, which is extraordinarily hot during the summer, with almost no heat deaths. Why? Because there's air conditioning.
One of the fastest growing areas in the country, Maricopa County. Yes.
That's right. And it's not like everybody's dying there, right?
No, they're dying to get there in some cases, but they're not dying there. You know,
So you're absolutely correct. Heat waves are really not the problem that is being made on. And cold waves are really worse. That's true.
So last question. You could have just stayed neutral. You could have just sat this one out. And because whenever you stand up and take a stand, the brickbats come flying. So what has been the impact on Cliff Mass since you went public with this on your weather blog, which is one of the most popular blogs here in Washington State, the most popular by any UW faculty member?
Well, as expected, you know, people started going after me, you know, for instance, the Progressive Institute, you know, they went after me on Twitter, for instance, you know,
we know them.
Very nasty stuff and saying things that are completely untrue. So that's going to happen, you know, and, you know, I'm worried, of course, that they'll try even more nasty things, complain to the UW and things like that. So I'm a little worried about that. But, you know, I think this is very important, and deceiving people about climate change as they're doing and pushing things that hurt low-income people, that's bad. And so I think it's important to stand up against it.
Well, good for you. And once again, I'm so glad that you are there to literally speak truth to power. Is there anything our listeners can do?
Well, they can vote for it. Vote yes on that initiative. And then... When politicians are coming up with these things that are just not true, you got to call them on them and tell them, you know, that they're not telling the truth. You know, maybe eventually we can change this ship around or move this ship around to a better direction.
You know, you're so right about that, Cliff. The reason why Seattle got into the deep trouble that it's in from crime, drugs, homelessness, is that too many politicians who were in a position to do something just looked the other way. When the far left was pushing Seattle policy instead of, you know, many moderate to liberal politicians and others, instead of pushing back, they just kind of backed away. They looked the other way, and look how bad things got because people didn't stand up and take a stand.
Right, and it's far beyond this. It's far beyond climate change. It includes the police problem, which is terribly serious. It's the problem of the homelessness in town. It is one issue after the other that we haven't been following a rational direction, and we're paying a terrible price for it. And that's what we have to change, to start using facts and rationality to deal with these great societal problems. We're not doing that. We have to do that.
So correct. So correct. Cliff Math, always great hearing your voice. Thanks again for joining us this morning.
Good to talk to you, John.
You got it. That's Cliff Math, the most esteemed climate scientist and weather expert in Washington State. Check out his great blog post, cliffmass.blogspot.com, or just Google Cliff Math blog. And two S's, of course, in mass. He really is someone who has been so honest, rigorously honest. And he's not guided by ideology. He's guided by facts, evidence, and reason, which are not at all to be found on the progressive left. And liberals are afraid of the progressive left, so that is why you have so many policies that are not tethered to facts, evidence, and reason that have taken sway in King County and in Seattle and in Olympia. Go ahead and tell us what's going on in the social media world when it comes to social media from socialists.
Yeah, since yesterday was Labor Day, I've got a story connected to that on social media. The social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort, and local union, hospitality workers, I guess, at Seattle hotels and things like that. It's called Local 8.
Yes.
And the Local 8 social media handle is at Unite Here Local 8. And they posted a picture of a couple of local politicians, two county council members, King County Council members, one Seattle City Council member. And they posted, "We want to thank Seattle City Council member Bob Kettle and King County Council members Claudia Balducci and Jorge Barón for joining us at the Westin Hotel there, downtown Seattle. Major downtown Seattle hotel." And Claudia Balducci is holding a sign, and it says, "On strike." And the placard, it says, "One job should be enough." And then the person, I guess, who is from the union is wearing a T-shirt, and it says, "One job should be enough." What one job? And what does enough mean? This is like the rich need to pay their fair share in taxes. Well, okay, what constitutes fair?
And
one job should be enough. Okay, what constitutes enough?
Is it a full-time job?
I don't know. But this is what's so vague and odd about this. And we've seen politicians here as we've gone through the primary season that have said the same sort of thing. Oh, you know, one job should be enough. What are you talking about when you say that? I worked three different jobs. One of them was full-time. Two of them were part-time, so I could advance my radio career when I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it took to get to the next better job that paid a little bit more, that had a little bit better benefits.
Almost.
And when you and I first crossed paths at TalkSpot.com, an internet webcasting site back in the late 1990s,
Rest in peace. That was
my third job.
Yeah. Yeah, look,
and then it became a full-time job for me.
Yes. You know, having a second job or a side gig is not unusual, especially if you are young and ambitious. You are looking for ways to advance. And so for someone to say one job is enough, that just implies that, well, that's all anyone works. Most people, if they have a full-time job, might have something going on the side, or they might have a part-time thing on weekends or what have you.
And I think this is another example.
This is what I've told both my sons. Yeah. You know, think about what will advance your career and get that job. And if you, whether it's a job you take during vacations or breaks,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that you do it and keep moving forward. Yeah.
Anyone who invokes this claim, one job should be enough, I think it proves that they do not understand how economics works.
It's coming up on 31 minutes after 6. When we return, college football began. Time to check in with our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carr. This is his side gig, I guess. All right. That's music, mood-setting music. We began college football throughout the country over the weekend. So we got to do a quick review of how the teams we care most about did. Matthew knows. That would be Matthew Carlson, our senior sports correspondent here on the commute with Carlson.
His second job?
That's his second job. And by the way, the ultimate irony, Claudia Balducci, I know Claudia. Claudia has regularly held two jobs.
Great reminder.
She's regularly held two jobs before she became a county councilwoman and is now, of course, running for county executive. Anyway, with that said, Matthew Carlson, welcome to the John Carlson Show. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Happy Tuesday. Hope everybody had a good Labor Day. And great to be here, Dad. Thank you.
Yes. And, of course, you were there covering the action at Husky Stadium on Saturday night.
Yes.
So tell us real quickly how you are feeling about the football season ahead for both. We'll be even-handed here. The University of Washington Huskies and the Washington State University Cougars.
Well, we'll start with the the Husky game that we all watched together, and that was a fun experience. By the way, announced attendance there 60,000+ people.
Yeah, I was surprised. So, I thought, you know, the students aren't back to school. Faculty and staff, most of them are not back. And, you know, it's Labor Day weekend and it's Weber State and maybe they'll get half the, they had over 60,000 people at the game.
John and Matt, everybody found out Comcast and Big Ten networks didn't get anything going for TV. So
if you wanted to see the game, you kind of had to go out to the stadium.
No choice.
Yeah, and that seems to be an ongoing issue. It is nebulous right now as to whether a couple of the other games this week will be broadcast. So we'll keep that in our, see how that goes going forward. But Washington, UW, you know, played with their food for a little while, couldn't get anything started. But they ended up beating Weber State, the Weber State Wildcats out of Ogden, 35-3, just kind of methodically running up the score. The big story of that game, Dad, we watched him score three times, was Jonah Coleman, the running back.
Yeah.
He had a great game. In fact, Pro Football Focus ranked him as the best performing running back in all of college football week one. 16 carries, 127 yards, and three touchdowns. On the ground, UW looked great.
He just needs to do that 12 more times, and he'll be the Heisman winner.
Yeah. And
on paper, yeah.
On paper, yeah. No, do that 12 more times, you'll have an all-world season. But the UW defense looked good, too. Again, Weber State, Big Sky opponent, FCS. So there's definitely going to be some more competitive, more difficult games down the stretch. And as we all know, they charged $40 for parking for this game. I don't know what they're going to charge for Michigan.
Oh, geez, get a second mortgage. I mean, it's just going to be ridiculous when that happens. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, now.
But yeah.
Off to Washington State University.
Off to the Palouse. Washington State put up a 70 spot on Portland State. Portland State did score first, so it was looking a little edgy at the beginning, a little sketchy. But Washington State ended up pulling away with a very comfortable victory. Just like Jonah Coleman dominated on the ground for UW, John Mateer dominated through the air for Wazoo. He had 352 yards passing and five touchdowns.
Wow.
Every passing touchdown was over 30 yards, 30, 39, 52, 58, and 59 yards. He scampered for 40 yards and a touchdown, too, for six total TDs.
The ghost of Mike Leach appears to have reappeared in Pullman. That's the kind of offense that Mike Leach used to run, isn't it?
Yeah, and they did it all despite the they didn't do the air raid offense like Mike. John Mateer just balled out of his mind. And Washington State, the one slight concern was that they gave up 30 to Portland State. They're projected to finish. They're in that same conference as Weber State, the Big Sky. But they did give up over 350 yards. So defense looking more than a little suspect, but the offense fully turbocharged. And they get to play Texas Tech this Saturday. That's a huge deal because, like you said, Coach Leach, rest in peace, coached both schools, and he will be inducted into the Wazoo Hall of Fame this weekend. So big game for Washington State and Texas Tech.
No, a lot on the line. I think, you know, it's against Texas State law to not be a good football team. So just about every football team out of Texas really is formidable.
A lot of visiting fans will come up from Lubbock and all around the Lone Star State to Pullman. So okay. that should be a lot of fun.
Real quickly, any surprises across the nation in week one of NCAA football?
Couple big surprises. I guess we can include last night too, but Florida State, who was griping and groaning about missing out on the college football playoff, has dropped their first two games in pretty horrific fashion. They lose to Georgia Tech over in Ireland. This is a team that thought they were top four in the country last year.
Yes.
And then proceed to lose at home to Boston College.
So ouch.
This is a team with college football playoff aspirations that has fallen flat on its face. The only
did they enter the season highly ranked? Phil says they were top 10.
Oh, yeah. They were ranked 10 as of last night against Boston College. So things are not going well for them to start the season. But a couple of things are going well. There's only one undefeated conference, and that would be the Pac-12, Pac-2. Oregon State and Washington State both winning their games this weekend.
The little conference that could. Yes.
Yes. Little conference. Still, by the way, for your listeners, it might be a little confusing because all the other teams left. It is the Pac-12 still that Oregon State and Washington State are in. It's still the logo on the football fields. It's still the entity that those two schools control, the money, the assets, and the media.
Okay.
But it is still the Pac-12.
All right. No, it's yeah. Oregon State, Washington State, and their 10 invisible friends make up the Pac-12.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, listen, while we have 30 seconds, the Seattle Mariners, Scott Service was relieved of his duties after almost 9 years, Dan Wilson takes over, of course, very popular catcher in his day, and his heyday was the Mariners' heyday. And there was some optimism there. You know, we won several series in a row, and then all of a sudden we lose a couple of heartbreakers that we should not have lost by one run. What's going wrong? What happened?
Yep. Well, every team every year has one team that they just can't seem to beat and get past, and for whatever reason, most unfortunately for the Mariners, that is the Los Angeles Angels. They are 1-8 in their last 9 meetings against the Angels. And, you know, that's 7 wins in the hole. And they're not a good baseball team. They're not going to finish with a winning record. In fact, I think they might have a they might be at 80 losses already. But they have just plagued the Mariners. Again, like you said, a painful walk-off loss to them. And losing 2 of 3 in Anaheim. And then last night, unfortunately, on the Mariners' final trip to Oakland before that team departs that city, they get walked off by the A's in game one of four on Labor Day.
They finished what?
They finished August 11 and 15, four games under 500,
jeez,
even despite a little Dan Wilson push at the end.
For our listeners,
for your listeners, sir,
what does it mean when you say walk-off?
A walk-off is for example, if the Mariners were at home and they won the game in the bottom of the ninth, or they scored the winning run in the bottom of the ninth, it's a walk-off because the game's over. It doesn't matter if there's one out.
So everyone can walk off the field.
It's the walk-off component is towards the losing team because they have to walk off the field, if that makes sense. Pitcher throws the pitch, run scores. They just walk off the field.
Walk off the field in defeat, in disgrace. Okay, that's what it means when you lose a walk-off game. All right, very good. So
Mariners have three more in Oakland. We'll see what they can do.
Well, if they don't start winning in Oakland, what are we down to, about 27 games now?
Yeah, within 1 month now. There are no October regularly scheduled baseball games. So
do the Mariners have
at the final days.
Do the Mariners have a better chance of winning the division or getting in on a wild card playoff spot? Is that still available?
That's a good question. If you'd asked me this a week ago, I would have said the division, and it wasn't close. They had a better chance of beating Houston. Now the odds have changed. They actually are a game or half a game or a game and a half closer in the wild card. So that represents a playoff opportunity. However, it's looking like if they did, they would be slipping into that third wild card spot, but they're still 4 or 5 games behind in order to get into that spot with, like you said, less than a month to go. The Mariners did blow a 10-game lead in 24 games, so hopefully they could, under the right magic, the right recipe, and the right set of circumstances, they could make up half that many.
All right.
In the same amount of time.
Let us hope that happens very soon. Matthew Carlson, another stellar sports report. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Matthew.
Always a pleasure, Dad. Great seeing the game with you this weekend.
All right.
Forward to covering some more.
Got it. Love you, son.
Bye.
It is 49 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, 11 minutes to 9 o'clock. Good. This should be an eye-opener. New York City, nearly 75%, 3 out of every 4 violent crime arrests in Midtown Manhattan are suspected illegal immigrants. Again, 3 out of every 4 people arrested for assault, domestic violence, robbery, shooting, stabbing in Midtown Manhattan are suspected of being in this country illegally. The New York Post reporting that police officers working at a disadvantage when they arrest suspected illegal immigrants because that city has a sanctuary law, like Seattle and, frankly, the state of Washington, that does not allow for cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement.
Does it say what they're getting arrested for?
Yes. Assault, domestic violence, robbery, shooting, stabbing. Quote, New York City eliminated a tool to get rid of violent criminals. What a mess, a former prosecutor at the Queens District Attorney's Office named Jim Quinn told the New York Post. The sanctuary law is pathetic in this city. It's disgusting. It's crazy. Again, this is the reality that Americans see when the issue of the border and illegal immigration come up. It's a view of the issue that too many people watching politics from the skybox don't see and hence don't pay attention to. Get out there and enjoy this wonderful day. Let's talk again tomorrow.